Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service of the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report, Babylon, the source of false religion, when we come back. Hey, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it should be pretty obvious to all of us that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools, they're banned from our public institutions, and now they've been banned from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple, time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place, and they're teaching these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto to our children in public school, our public institutions. We've made them a part of our national psyche, and I contend that this is a pretty radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years. Now, are you aware that your daughter, for instance, couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion? That's right, she can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent. Now, that's why I contend that the solution to this kind of moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. What did we do in the past? I contend we should go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law, because our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's at least one school left in America that still teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, commandments, as well as the penalties and the 33 benefits that we all receive for their observance. Now, you know every law has a penalty, and you don't have to particularly know what it is, what is that penalty, to suffer from its effect. Now, whether we call this the Mosaic Law, the Law of God, the Common Law, Natural Law, or we call it karma or something else, it's automatic. It just works like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happened to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. And it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website. The website's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And when you get there, you just click onto the email machine and send me an email request for that free General Law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Babylon. You know, when we think of Babylon, you know, we think of some ancient old ruin sitting out here someplace in the Mesopotamian plain. It brings to my mind a guy by the name of Nebuchadnezzar eating grass for 7 years. He was the king of Babylon. And I think about Daniel in the lion's den. He went into the lion's den there in Babylon. A lot of big events in biblical history occurred in this place called Babylon. In fact, there's an important source, or there's an important story or source of information contained in the last book in the Bible. It's called Revelation concerning Babylon. Now, in our modern era, today, you know, there's something to be said in the Bible about Babylon. The mystery religion, it's referred to in the Bible. The mystery religion of Babylon has been symbolically described in the last book of the Bible, Revelation, as a woman arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and then decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. You can read that little story. It's in Revelation chapter 17, verses 1 through 6. And this church in here is described as the mother of harlots. So it's not the only church. There's a bunch of daughter churches that come out of this mother church. So I put my mind to it, you know, and I looked at it and I said, God, that sounds like the Catholic Church and the Protestant daughters that come out of her. Why don't you read it? You know, you can come to a conclusion. Maybe you'll come up with something else, and maybe it'll be something different than that. But whatever this is that the Bible is describing here is a system of religion that is filthy. It's rotten to the core, full of abominations. God says this is an abominable practice. Now, when the Bible uses symbolic language, a woman can symbolize a church. Now, the true church, for example, is likened to a bride, a chaste virgin, a woman without spot or blemish. And you'll see that in Ephesians 5, verse 27, Revelation 19, verses 7 and 8. But here, in Revelation 17, is a striking contrast. It's an unclean woman, a defiled woman. It's a harlot, a whore, a slut pictured. And if it is here correct to apply the symbolism to a church system, it is clear that only a defiled and fallen church could be meant. In big capital letters, the Bible calls her Mystery Babylon. Now, when John wrote the book of Revelation, Babylon, as a city and empire, had already been destroyed and left in ruins. As the Old Testament prophets had foretold,
For instance, in Isaiah 13, verses 19 through 22, and Jeremiah 51, verse 52. But the religious practices and concepts and customs that originated in Babylon continued on and were well represented in many nations around the world. Just what was the religion of ancient Babylon? And how did it all begin? What significance does it hold for us now in modern times? And how does it all, or how does it all tie together with what John wrote in the book of Revelation? So, turning the pages of time back to the period shortly after the flood, when men began to migrate from the east, and it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. That's recorded in Genesis 11, verse 2. And it was here that the city of Babylon was built, and this land became known as Babylonia, and then later as Mesopotamia. Today we call it Iraq. It was here the Euphrates and Tigris rivers had built up rich deposits of earth that could produce crops in abundance. But there were certain problems that the people faced, because, for one thing, the land was overrun with wild animals, which were a constant threat to the safety and peace of the inhabitants. We'll see that in Exodus 23, verses 29 and 30. And obviously, anyone who could successfully provide protection from these wild beasts would receive great acclaim from the people as a mighty hunter. Now, it was at this point that a large, powerfully built man by the name of Nimrod appeared on the world scene. He became famous as a mighty hunter against the wild animals. And the Bible tells us, quote, "And Cush begat Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod the mighty hunter before the Lord," Genesis 10, verses 8 and 9. Now, apparently Nimrod's success as a mighty hunter caused him to become famous among those primitive people, and he became a mighty one in the earth. He became a famous leader in world affairs. Gaining this prestige, he devised a better means of protection. Instead of constantly fighting the wild beasts, why not organize the people into cities and surround the cities with walls of protection? Then, why not organize these cities into a kingdom? Well, eventually, this was the thinking of Nimrod, because the Bible tells us that he organized such a kingdom. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. We read that in Genesis 10:10. And the kingdom of Nimrod is the first mentioned kingdom in the Bible. Now, whatever advances may have been made by Nimrod would have been well and good. But Nimrod was an ungodly ruler. And the name Nimrod comes from Merad, meaning he rebelled. And the expression that he was a mighty one before the Eternal can carry a hostile meaning, the word before being sometimes used as meaning against or in place of the Lord. The Jewish Encyclopedia says that Nimrod was he who made all the people rebellious against God. The noted historian Josephus wrote, quote, "Now it was Nimrod who excited them so much, and to such an affront and contempt of God, he also gradually changed the government into a tyranny. Seeing no other way of turning men from the fear of God, the multitudes were very ready to follow the determination of Nimrod, and they built a tower, neither sparing any pains, nor being in any degree negligent about the work. And by reason of the multitude of hands employed in it, it grew very high. The place wherein they built the tower is now called Babylon." Now, basing his conclusions on information that has come down to us in history, legend, and mythology, Alexander Hislop has written in detail of how Babylonian religion developed around traditions concerning Nimrod, his wife Semiramis, and her child Tammuz. When Nimrod died, according to the old legends, the stories about him and his body, it was cut into pieces and then burned, and then sent to various areas. Similar practices are mentioned in the Bible in places like Judges 19, verse 29, and 1 Samuel 11, verse 7. Now, the Bible doesn't specifically say this, but it historically is rumored about, and I think this comes either from Hislop or from Josephus, that it was Shem who killed Nimrod. Now, remember, Shem was on the ark. Now, the year the flood ended, Shem was about 100, I believe he was 100 years old. Certainly not over 200 years old, and he lived to be 600 years old. So, this Tower of Babel occurred 300 or 400 years after the flood, but it was Shem who was still alive. You want to remember that these people were living to 900 years old. Noah lived 300 years after he got off the ark. He was 600 when he got off of it, but he lived to be 900 years old. Now, these people, as they're multiplying, you know, a lot of times people, you know, they go to public school and they think that the population of the world was very tiny. If you'll take a look at populations, they grow geometrically. They grow 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. They double every so many years. And the number of these doublings, you know, if you took a penny and doubled it every day for 32 days, you know, took one penny, two pennies, four pennies, eight pennies, at the end of 32 days, you'd have $40 million, doubling it 32 times. So if you double the population, and you do that 32 times, let me just test it for you here. You start off with two people on day one, double them every 40 years. And by the time you have doubled those, you know, for 32 doublings, that'd be 32 doublings times 40 years. In 1,280 years, you'd have 40 million people. So if you double these people every 20 years, you know, we call a generation 20 years, and people that are 20 years old very commonly have children. So if we took the same doubling, you know, 32 times, and then 20 years for a generation, that'd be 32 times 20. And then 640 years, we'd have 40 million people. Now, there's no reason to believe that the world's population back in those days was breeding at a lesser rate than they are today. You know, we have this birth control thing going on today, and here in the United States, we barely maintain our population through reproduction, but around the world, the average birth rate's around 3.6. And the world's population right now today is doubling about every 10 to 15 years. And this doubling period gets shorter and shorter. You know, the world's population doubled between 1600 and 1940. Or about 1600 to 1900, in 300 years, the world's population doubled. It doubled from 2 billion to 4 billion between about 1940 and 1970 or 80. And it's in the process of doubling from 4 billion to 8 billion. And it won't take, you know, 70 or 80 years for it to double from 4 to 8. It'll take half that time or less. Now, that's called the magic of compounding, or geometric progression. Well, following Nimrod's death, which was greatly mourned by the people of Babylon, his wife, Semiramis, claimed that he was now the sun god. It should be pointed out here that this Semiramis not only was his wife, but also his mother. So he married his mother. It was an incestuous relationship. Later, when she gave birth to a son, she claimed that her son Tammuz, by name, was their hero that called Nimrod reborn. And the accompanying cuts show the way Tammuz came to be represented in classical art. So when you go into a church and you see Mary, you know, the Madonna and child, what you're really looking at here is Semiramis. We don't have a picture of Mary, but we do have these woodcuts, you know, from historical times. And they picture this woman and her baby. This is the Madonna and child, or Mary and Jesus. It's a pagan superstition. Now, the mother of Tammuz was probably heard, or had probably heard, the prophecy of the coming Messiah to be born of a woman. And for this truth was known from the earliest times. In Genesis 3, verse 15, it's recorded. And she claimed her son was supernaturally conceived, and that he was the promised seed, the Savior, in the religion that developed. However, not only was the child worshipped, but the mother was worshipped also. So this worship of the mother and child, of Mary and Jesus, was going on in the Babylonian mystery religion because of the prophecy in Genesis 3:15. Now, much of the Babylonian worship was carried on through mysterious symbols. It was a mystery religion. And since the deified Nimrod was believed to be the sun, that's the S-U-N, the sun god, fire was considered his earthly representation. That's why we have candles and halos around people's heads. That halo represents the sun disk. And thus, as we shall see, candles and ritual fires were lighted in his honor. In other forms, he was symbolized by sun images, fish, trees, pillars, and animals. Now, centuries later, the Apostle Paul gave a description which perfectly fits the course that the people of Babylon followed. When they knew God, they glorified him not as God, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man, and to birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. They changed the truth of God into a lie, and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator. And it's for this cause that God gave them up to vile affections. This is in Romans 1, verses 21 through 26, which is quite an expose on homosexual perversion. Now, this system of idolatry spread from Babylon to the nations, for it was from this location that men were scattered over the face of the earth, in Genesis 11, verse 9. And as they went from Babylon, they took their worship of the mother and child, and the various mystery symbols with them. Herodias, the world traveler and historian of antiquity, I call him Herodotus, but a lot of people call him Herodias. They witnessed the mystery religion and its rites in numerous countries, and mentions how Babylon was the primeval source from which all these systems of idolatry flowed. Bunsen says that the religious system of Egypt was derived from Asia and the primitive empire of Babel. And in his noted work, Nineveh and Its Remains, Lehler declares that we have the united testimony of sacred and profane history, that idolatry originated in the area of Babylonia, the most ancient of religious systems. All of these historians were quoted by Hyslop. Now, when Rome became a world empire, it's a known fact that Rome assimilated into its system the gods and religions from the various pagan countries over which the Roman Empire had conquered and ruled. Now, since Babylon was the source of this paganism, the pagan idolatry of these countries, we can see how the early religion of pagan Rome was just another form of the Babylonish worship that had developed into its various forms and under different names in the countries to which it had gone. Today we call it Christianity. In bygone eras, it's had different names in different societies and cultures. Now, bearing this in mind, we notice that it was during the time when Rome was ruling the world that the true Savior, Jesus of Nazareth, was born, living among men. He died, he rose again from the dead, he ascended into heaven. He sent back the Holy Spirit, and the New Testament church was established here in the earth. What glorious days. One only has to read the book of Acts to see how much God blessed his people in those early days. Multitudes were added to the church. Great signs and wonders were performed as God confirmed his word with signs following. Christianity, as we call it today, anointed by the Holy Spirit, swept the world like a prairie fire. It encircled the mountains and crossed the oceans. It made kings to tremble and tyrants to fear. And it was said of those early Christians that they had turned the world upside down. So powerful was their message and the Spirit of God, as we read in Acts 17, verse 6. But before too many years had passed, however, men began to set themselves up as lords over God's people in place of the Holy Spirit. And instead of conquering by spiritual means and by truth, as in the early days, men began to substitute their ideas and their methods. Attempts to merge paganism into Christianity were being made even in the days when our New Testament was being written. And the Apostle Paul mentioned that this mystery of iniquity was already at work, and he warned the people that there would come a great falling away, and that some would depart from the truth, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils. He said it would be a counterfeit doctrine of the pagans in 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 and 7, and 1 Timothy 4, verse 2. So by the time that Jude wrote, the little book of Jude that bears his name, it was necessary for Jude to exhort the people to earnestly contend for the faith that was once delivered unto the saints. Because certain men had crept into the church who were attempting to substitute things that were no part of the original faith. We read that in Jude 1, verses 3 and 4. So Christianity had now come face to face with the Babylonian paganism in its various forms that had been established in the Roman Empire. The early Christians refused to have anything to do with its customs and beliefs. Much persecution then resulted. Many Christians were falsely accused, they were thrown into the lions, they were burned at the stake, and in other ways they were tortured and martyred. Then great changes began to be made. The Emperor of Rome professed conversion to Christianity. Imperial orders went forth throughout the empire that persecutions should cease. Bishops then were given high honors. The church began to receive worldly recognition and power. But for all of this, a great price had to be paid. And that is, many compromises had to be made with the pagans and the pagan religious customs that they brought into this Christian-pagan amalgam. Now, instead of the church being separate from the world, the church became a part of the world system, a part of the political process. Today we call it 501c3 tax exemption. Now the emperor, showing favor, demanded a place of leadership in the church, because in paganism, emperors were believed to be a god. So from here on, wholesale mixtures of paganism into Christianity were made, and especially at the world capital of Rome. Now we believe the pages which follow prove that it was this mixture of paganism, the Babylonian mystery religion, along with Christianity, as Christianity was known at that time in the early period, it was that mixture that produced this system, which is known today as the Roman Catholic Church. Now, we have no doubt that there are many fine, sincere, and devout Catholics. We're not criticizing people's religious belief and faith or their sincerity. It's not our intention to treat lightly or to ridicule anybody whose beliefs we may here disagree with. Instead, we hope that this book will inspire everyone, regardless of their religious affiliation, to forsake these Babylonish doctrines, these pagan practices, and seek a return to the faith that was once delivered unto the saints. That is the scripture, the Bible, which, by the way, as we showed you a little earlier in this series, that it's against the church doctrine for Catholics to read the Bible. I was talking to a Catholic here the other day in class, and he said, well, not that he knew of. Now, things may have changed, and perhaps they've changed for the better. So, you know, if you're a Catholic and you can read the Bible now, that's fine. But keep in mind that there was a time here when you couldn't. The Reformation brought about widespread distribution of the Bible, and for many centuries the Roman Catholic Church opposed such distribution of the Scripture. Pope Pius IV stated that the Bible is not for the people, and whosoever will be saved must renounce it, the Bible. It is a forbidden book. Bible societies are satanic contrivances. So said Pope Pius IV. In 1198 AD, Innocent III, this is Pope Innocent, now issued a decree that all who read the Bible should be put to death. In 1229, the Council of Toulouse passed a decree forbidding either the possession or reading of the Bible, as did also the famous Council of Trent. Pius VII in 1816 denounced Bibles as pestilences. Gregory XVI in 1844 condemned Bible societies and ordered priests to tear up all that they could lay their hands on. So as recently as 1844, you know, which isn't all that long ago, you know, the United States was in operation in 1844. You know, about 150 or 60 years ago, you know, the Catholic Church was telling you Catholics out there that this Bible now is bad for you. And I think that's really counterproductive, because when you tell people, you know, don't eat off that tree, you know, the first thing they're going to do is go over there and eat off of it. If you want to test this, you know, just go in and tell your kid that he should read The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, you know, by, there's a famous author out there, you know, named Gibbons, who wrote a book called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empires in three volumes, and it's a big 1,600-page book. And I think every kid ought to read The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, but tell your kid to read it, and you can be absolutely certain and guaranteed that if that kid lives to be 110 years old, he will never read Gibbon's book. Never. Never. What you do is you discourage him coming right out of the chute. That's what happened to me. I was told that the greatest book on world history was Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, written in 1776 by Edward Gibbon. And then I was cautioned, don't try to read it, though, because it's 1,600 pages and three volumes, and it's way more than you can handle, little Georgie. Don't you even think about it. Put it out of your mind. Well, you can figure immediately what I did. I got right out there and got with the program. I said, I got to read this. So when you tell people not to read the Bible, you know, all of a sudden, you got all these millions of people. No, a lot of people, they'll follow that advice. But you'll find a lot of people, and that's where the Protestants are coming from. You know, these Protestants, they say, don't read the Bible. And right away, well, what are they trying to hide? And so then all these Protestants start reading the Bible. And then they find out the other side of the story, and they say, well, what in the hell is this all about? And then they leave the Catholic Church and cause a lot of hate and discontent and so on. All right, so let me give you a reminder here. We're at the halfway point. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. Now, if you'd like to have more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And if you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate, and that's because most of these authors and the publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile. They could be political, they may be religious, they could be economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, and they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers or the sponsors or the management or the staff of this network or local radio station, because these people are probably pretty normal. But if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And click on to the email, send us an email request for that free general law CD package, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Many of the practices that we observe today in Christianity, in the practices, you know, both Catholic and Protestant, I'm not here just zeroing in on Catholics, because the Protestants follow this same Babylonian mystery religion. You know, Christmas is prohibited in the Bible. And we're told with specificity not to learn the doctrines of the Nicolaitans, not to practice these pagan practices like going out into the woods and cutting down a tree and bringing it in and decking it with gold and silver, as we see in Jeremiah 10. So we've been told not to practice that. Now, that's exactly what we practice. So if God told us, you know, if God really wanted us to follow a specific course of action, then he should instruct us in the Bible. Go out in the woods and cut out a tree and then deck it with gold and silver, because we wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. I mean, if God told us to come in, we'd go out. And if he told us to sit down, we'd stand up. It's been that way from day one. He told Adam and Eve, don't eat off that tree, and they couldn't wait. As soon as he turned his back, they were over there eating off of it. And that's what human beings do. It's what we call human nature. You know, you tell a kid, don't do that, and he's going to go right over there and do it. I mean, you know that as well as I do. So you use what we call reverse psychology. You know, if you want somebody to read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, you tell them, but don't you waste your time. You're not smart enough. You're dumb. You'd never be able to read 1,600 pages, little Georgie. And so little Georgie, you know, he sneaks down to the public library and gets a copy of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire and starts reading secretly at night. I don't know how long it took me. It took me several months sneaking down to the Eureka Public Library and reading these forbidden fruits. Well, that's what people do. You encourage people, you tell them, read the Bible. Hell, they wouldn't touch that Bible with a 10-foot pole. And you tell them, don't read Hustler or Playboy. Why they'll be out there, and why they'll spend 10 bucks on a Playboy so they can look at the centerfold. It's the way people are. And so the same thing is true here in religion. Nothing's changed. You know, you probably act just like I do. You know, if I said, do this, you won't. And if I said, don't do it, you would. And so we try to give our children good advice. We say, well, read this. You know, hey, look at this. And then we shake our heads and say, I don't understand my kid. He runs around with his pants down around his knees, and he's got earrings in his ears, and he's got purple hair, and I just don't understand it. I told him not to do that. Now go tell your kid, you know, your hair looks terrible. Why don't you go dye it purple? God, your ears are kind of plain, son. Why don't you go get some earrings, and while you're at it, stick two of them in your lip. He wouldn't touch those with a 10-foot pole. Now we come to chapter 2, and it deals with this thing of the mother and child worship. You ever wonder about that? You know, Catholics do that. The Protestants, no. They reject this. And that's because they were told to do it, and then, of course, they won't. So they're just rebelling against the Catholic Church. And the Catholics, they get mad about these rebels over here, so they want to punish the rebels by burning them at the stake. So a lot of Protestant reformers got killed. And Fox's Book of Martyrs, they tell us that about 100 million people got killed in these inquisitions, you know, back during the Middle Ages. We don't know if it's 100 million or 50 million or 20 million, but it was a bunch. You know, I see various numbers, and people write me letters, and they say, well, Gordon, you're wrong about that. See, I read this book over here, and it says there were 50 million, and you said there was 100 million. Well, you know, boys and girls, it is true that if one book says 50 and another one says 100, they both can't be right. But they both could be wrong, and maybe it's 110, or maybe it's 90. I wasn't there. I didn't keep track when we're talking about estimates. But wouldn't you agree that if some organization went out and killed 50 million people over 347 years, that would be an atrocity? What if they only killed 25 million people? Wouldn't that be an atrocity? What if they only killed 12.5 million people? Isn't that an atrocity? Hitler killed 6 million Jews, and you people are bombarded with this Holocaust story constantly, aren't you? I don't know if he killed 6 million or 3 million, but you know, 3 million is an atrocity. 6 million is an atrocity. 6,000 is an atrocity. You know, the Saddam Hussein killed 5 or 6,000 Kurds with poison gas, and we call that an atrocity, and we executed him for it. It was one of the crimes that we said that he was guilty of. We Americans are responsible now for 600,000 Iraqi deaths. I don't know that this is true, but I don't think Saddam Hussein killed 600,000 people in his entire reign. Did he? Have you got any evidence that Saddam Hussein killed more Iraqis than the Americans have in 4 years of war over there? Because from what I see, you know, the reports coming across my desk, I don't see that. Now, we Americans are very righteous. We're just god-awful righteous. And I told you the story the other day. Columbus came over here to the New World on his very first voyage. He put many Indians over here. This is Native Americans. He put them to death, and he didn't just kill them. He burned them to death. Columbus, Christopher Columbus, you know, the famous explorer, and we celebrate his discovery of America every October the 12th. You know, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and we celebrate his arrival here in the New World. This is Columbus. He was a Catholic. You know, God bless him. He was just a fine, upstanding, righteous Catholic man going to Mass every Sunday. He got over here to the New World, met these new people over here. He thought he was an Indian. And his real motivation, at least this is what the historians tell us, he came over here looking for new lands, gold, spices, and wealth. When he got over here, one of the subparts of his mission was to convert all these people to Christianity. You people in India can thank God that Christopher Columbus didn't get to your country, because he was going to burn you people at the stake. That's what he did to the Native Americans over here. If they converted to Christianity, they were all right. They had to convert to Catholicism, that brand of Christianity. And if they didn't, he'd burn them at the stake. And that's why I've told you, you know, for the last several programs, is that God, these Christians out here just scare the living hell out of me. Now, if I had my druthers here, you know, between an evolutionist and a Christian, I'd pick that evolutionist every time. I can readily understand why academians and science and people, you know, that are educated reject religion. What? God, that makes I do too. Boy, I reject religion. I'm staying as far away from that stuff as I can get. I told you about this John Hagee guy down here, and I was talking, I gave you a bad report here the other day. I said John Hagee is advocating that we bomb or that we go to war against Iran. That was only half the story. I guess I was so shocked when I saw Bill Moyer's report, and maybe Moyer's report didn't contain this. Hagee isn't just advocating bombing Iraq. He wants a nuclear strike, a preemptive first strike nuclear attack. I was corrected the other day. I mentioned this, and two or three people were sitting there, and you, Gordon, you ain't got half the story. I said, oh my God, you got to be kidding me. This guy represents the evangelical Christians of America. I don't say he represents all of them. You know, I guess there's some of you people out there can think for yourselves, but there's 70 million. That's what I'm informed. I've interviewed these 70 million people, and I haven't heard 70 million people tell me, yes, indeed, Mr. Gordon, I am an evangelical Christian, but I get reports across my desk, and I see numbers that stretch up to about 70 million. That's a hell of a bunch of people, you know, 70 million people. And here's a guy, big church, 1,600 people down here in San Antonio, Texas, and he gets up there, I guess, every once in a while and says, hey, kids, here's what we need to do. Here's what I would recommend. And I kind of thought war was a pretty significant step. And, of course, maybe this guy thinks he's going to get out of this thing scot-free, but, you know, it would seem like to me, I tested this a couple times, it would seem like to me that if we go over there to Iran and we drop a nuclear weapon on the Iranians, I think they're going to get mad as hell. And I know, I went in a bar one time, and I hauled a guy off a bar stool, and I busted him in the nose, and I noticed he got mad as hell. He got real angry with me. And then we went at it. And, you know, you can be a big guy, and you can go in there, and you can grab some little guy, you know, off the bar stool, and bounce him around off the barroom floor. But you've got to be careful about doing that. Now, while you can whip this little guy, you know, he's no big deal, sometimes these little guys have great big friends. So, you know, when you walk into the bar and you see this little guy on the bar stool over there and you think, well, I'll just go over there and raise hell with him. You know, you want to look around and maybe bide your time a little bit and see, well, who's his buddies? Because, you know, he might have a couple of great big buddies over here playing pool over there on the pool table. And you go over here and you start raising hell with this little guy, and all of a sudden you got two of his great big buddies over here along with this little guy. That's what I'm kind of thinking about with these Iranians. See, the Iranians, they're kind of little kids on the block, but they got these two great big buddies. One of them's China and the other one's Russia. You got another great big kid over here on the block. The Japanese buy much. I don't know exactly how much, but they buy a lot of their oil from the Iranians. And, you know, it's one thing to go over there and pick on this little country like Iraq. You know, I mean, here's the United States of America going to war against Iraq, you know, which is kind of like Russia going to war against Estonia. There's a little doubt in my mind, but what if the Russians go to war against Poland? If I was a betting man, I'd bet on Russia. See? And so, you know, when America goes to war against Iraq, my betting instincts would say, I think I'll bet on the Americans. I think they'll probably take the Iraqis and clean their clock. Now, but when you start looking at Russia and China along with Iran, you know, I mean, we are pretty tough nuts, you know, and we got a couple of big guys over here. You know, you got the United States, and then you got the NATO countries of Western Europe. They're pretty powerful, too, you know. So, you know, here's the Chinese and the Russians, and you know, against the Americans and the Western Europeans. That's kind of, you know, and then what happens? You end up here with a barroom brawl. And that's where the furniture starts getting torn up, you know, and that's where the mirrors get broken and the bottles of whiskey behind the bar get busted, you know, and things like that. You know, you've probably seen that, you know, in the movies. John Wayne comes in, starts raising hell. And pretty soon a couple other guys get into the fracas, and, you know, pretty soon they're throwing chairs around and just raising hell. And in biblical terms, this is called the Battle of Armageddon. This is called the Great Tribulation. You know, we're getting down here to where it looks like to me that you're starting to get real close to home plate. Now, this Battle of Armageddon takes place 35 miles northwest of Jerusalem, which for you Jews over there is getting pretty close to downtown, 35 miles northwest of Jerusalem, wherein 200 million, now that's a bunch, 200 million, that's all of the people in the United States east of the Mississippi River are going to get into a big bitch with a bunch of other people that I would presume are going to appear with somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 million also. Typically, you know, when two armies come together, they try as hard as they can, you know, as best as possible, to match up the numbers on each side, you know, so that one side does not have an unequal advantage. Now, I will concede the Bible does not tell us how many are going to be on our side, but it does tell us there's going to be 200 million on the other side. Now, those Iranians teamed up with the Chinese, I think, could produce 200 million soldiers on their side. So far, we Americans have only got 160,000 in Iraq, and they tell us that we're already at the breaking point. So that means that, you know, you take all the people of Palestine, that would be about 5 million, all you Jews over there. So you got 160,000 American soldiers in Iraq. Then you got 5 million Jews. And I suppose we Americans, if we put our minds to it, with 300 million people in this country, when we had a population of 150 million back in World War II, we had 16 million men under arms. I imagine we could probably put 30 million under arms today. And I imagine you Europeans could probably do the same thing. That's 30 and 30 is 60 million. And the Chinese over there have 1.3 billion people, and it seems like to me that 200 million could probably come out of there. I don't know about the Indians and the Japs now. I don't know where they're coming down on this fracas, but, I mean, we're talking about some heavy-duty stuff here. And it kind of centers around this Western Christian civilization versus the Eastern civilization. That's kind of the way I see this deal coming down. And we here in the West have a real long history of long nose out of joint. We Americans have our nose in everybody's business. And boys, I want to tell you that that's real bad. And if you want to test this, you just walk into any bar anywhere in America and just walk up to anybody sitting at the bar and start sticking your nose into this guy's business, asking questions like, what are you drinking, mate? Where do you work, buster? You know, and I think you can stir up a lot of hate and discontent in short order. And we Americans just seem to be able to stir up hate and discontent everywhere we go. We stirred it up with the Hawaiians. We stirred it up with the Mexicans. Now we've stirred it up with the Afghanis. We've stirred it up with the Muslims. We've stirred it up with the Iraqis. Just start looking around the world. And then start asking people, well, what do you think of the Americans over there? Hell, I don't think anybody in the world likes us. And if there's anybody out there, I mean, if you could send me a news clipping someplace that says, hey, the people of Poland just love Americans. The reports that I'm seeing over here across my desk is that, you know, the populations, when they're queried in various countries, they don't like us at all. Sometimes they say, well, we like Americans, but we hate American foreign policy. We don't like your government. We don't like your banks. We don't like your morals. That wasn't always the case. I can remember when I was a kid, people liked Americans, and they liked America, and they liked what we stood for. That's becoming increasingly rare today. So I just take a look around the world, and I'm looking at this problem over here in the Middle East. It has a religious problem. You know, if we Americans actually practiced the Scripture, I mean, if we actually obeyed our Creator, if we obeyed God and kept His commandments, we would have a different religious ideology. I don't think that we would be running around telling our parishioners that we need a preemptive nuclear strike against some other country. That isn't what I read in the Bible. I can't speak for Hagee and 70 million other Christians over there. Now, that's why I tell you people out there, boy, don't count me in now with these Christians. I don't want to be counted in here with that gang. I don't want to go over here and bomb a bunch of people over here. And you know, this nuclear weapon over here is a very highly indiscriminate killer. I mean, I'll agree with you. There's probably a lot of bad guys out there that need killing. But I find it hard to believe that by dropping a nuclear weapon on Tehran over there so that you can kill all these bad guys over there, whoever these bad guys are, that you're not going to have some collateral damage, that you're not going to kill a bunch of people that really don't have a hell of a lot to do with these bad guys over here. That's the thing about bombing people that is, in my view, you know, kind of poor. In the Bible, if you'll take a look in Ezekiel chapter 18, God, the Creator God, He is very adamant about punishing the exact person who is guilty of the crime. And He says, you know, a son who has a father who is a rounder shall not die for the sins of his father. And a father who has a wayward son shall not die for the sins of his father, but the father shall die for his sins, and the son shall die for his sins. And I think those Iraqis and Iranians, and there's probably a lot of bad guys, and maybe they need killing, and I would imagine George Bush is probably a better judge at who needs to die and who should live than I am. I wouldn't doubt that at all. But I don't want to be a part of some program that indiscriminately kills a bunch of people. So I just wanted to voice my opposition coming right out of the chute, Mr. Hagee. I don't want to be a part of your program. Just count me out, would you please? And I imagine I'll be called a coward and an un-American and a terrorist and 15 other things over there. Well, get after it. Go ahead. But count me out, I dissent. I don't want to know that. Now, these religious people, you know, they probably mean real well, and I'm sure that these Catholics back in the Middle Ages, killing 100 million Protestants over here, meant real well, and they intended all kinds of good things to come out of this. But taking women and children and locking them up in a barn and torching it off and killing them, you know, I take a look at a little Jewish kid, you know, over here in Palestine, and I got to ask myself, you know, probably his parents are real jerks and need killing, and I'm sure that all you Muslims over there agree with that. But what I have a problem with is, what'd that kid do? What's this 5-year-old kid got, you know, with your bitch, with his mom and dad? And for you Jews over there, you know, you got all these little Palestinian kids running around over. What's a 10-year-old Palestinian kid got to do, you know, with this bitch that you've got with these Palestinians? And we Americans over here have had a long tradition, as long as I've been alive, of being careful about killing women. And I take a look around the world today, and these people seem to take great relish in killing women and kids. And that includes Americans. They're over there in Iraq just killing women and kids, just one after another. And then you wonder why those Muslims over there have got a bitch with you. And I'm telling you, you know, when you run around, test it out here locally at home. Walk into any bar in America. Walk up to the bar stool, tip this guy's glass of beer over and slap him across the face and then see what he does. If you think something's good going to come out of that, well, you know, send me an email. Let me know, would you? I've tested that a couple of 3 times and I didn't see anything good coming out of it. You know, when I walk in the bar now, you know, and I sit down at the bar, you know, I can keep a civil tongue in my head, keep my nose out of other people's business. And then I found out from long experience, you know, if you butt out of other people's business, you can sit there at the bar, drink your beer, walk out, and probably have all your blood running through your veins, you know, but you get a long nose and you start screwing around with people, and pretty soon, you know, you walk out of the bar, stagger out of the bar, and you've lost a lot of blood, and then you got a lot of pain, suffering, and anguish to go along with it. And that's where we Americans are today with this Iraqi war. So if you're wondering why you got all this pain, suffering, and anguish, you got to ask yourself, you know, and did you go down there? You know, if you think that somebody needs to be freed, you know, why don't we go down to Cuba and free those people from communist oppression under Fidel Castro? You know, if you just want to really spread democracy around the world, why don't we go over to North Korea and straighten that jerk out? And the answer to that is there's no oil in Cuba and there's no oil in North Korea. Now, the North Koreans are starving to death. If anybody needs democracy, it's the North Koreans. The Iraqis under Saddam Hussein might have been hungry, but they weren't starving. So there's that story. All right, so keep in mind then that the root cause of what's going on around the world is religion. And we Americans are the chief of the religious right who are out here spreading democracy and beating the tom-toms for war. And I would suspect that we're going to get it. You walk into a bar, boys and girls, looking for a fight, and you won't have to go very far. You just sidle up to the bar, find the biggest, meanest, nastiest looking guy up there and tip his beer over, and then you'll have it. All right, guys, we're out of time, so I'm going to have to tell you again that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information, then go to the law school website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. If you'd like to order one, then call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Our time's about up. We'll have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.